great. I'll give it over to you.
Yeah. Thank you. So the centerpiece today is an hour-long video entitled Journey of the Universe. And we'll get to that, but the backstory is essential here. And we need to talk for most of maybe 45 minutes this first hour and then watch the video, the second hour. Now, here's the backstory. Mary Evelyn Tucker, who is a historian of religions at Yale University, and Brian Swim, who is an astrophysicist, were both deeply influenced by Father Thomas Berry. Thomas Berry is a Roman Catholic priest who was a part of an order, the Passionists, who was influenced by Teilhard de Chardin, who was a rather famous paleontologist who was also a Jesuit priest. And some of you may know Mass on the World or Hymn of the Earth or the Divine Milieu. All of these folks were convinced that the world is in crisis because it doesn't have a livable story, a non-self-destructible story. The narrative that we live by, consumerism, industrialized nature, white privilege, is now self-destructive in their judgment. And so, for a variety of reasons that have to do with the kind of world we're living in and the kind of relationship we have with the rest of nature, and you will always hear me say the rest of nature, not nature, that's the problem, is to think humanity and nature. We are bodies. The bodies we are only 10% uniquely human cells in them. There's a zoo in you. And if those, the rest of your, you're only living by the kindness of strangers, bacteria, basically. And if they decide to go on strike, it's all over for you. You'll be returning to Stardust sooner than you planned. So, you are only possible because you are a mammal. I had a good friend, Cindy Molibita, co-author of one of the books, who gave a talk, Adam wasn't a guy and Jesus was a mammal. Well, we're all mammals. And so, we are not here except for the rest of nature. And it's not human beings and creation. It's humanity as part of nature, as part of creation. Now, one of the focal points in the journey of the universe is the human relationship to the rest of nature that has developed since the Industrial Revolution. And I'm just going to show you two pages of what are now famous graphs that show you what that relationship has been. Whoops. All right. They're trying to authenticate me here.
Cancel that.
All right. Okay. Let's see if we can get the full page there. Now, this is the first page of graphs. The graphs were put together by an international group of scientists called the Geosphere-Biosphere Project. And all they did was collect data in a wide variety of domains and then correlated. And the date that you see at the left is 1750, which is the conventional onset date for the Industrial Revolution. So this is a set of graphs that tries to say how humanity's relationship to the rest of nature has proceeded since the onset of modernity, really, with the Industrial Revolution. And the date you see on the right-hand side is 2000, There is further evidence. I don't have the graphs that go beyond 2000. And for some years, for a lot of years, we don't have any data. So for McDonald's restaurants here, we don't know how many there were in 1750. I mean, there were a lot of McDonald's, you know, in Scotland at the time. Some of them surely had restaurants, but it wasn't until after 1950 that they really took off. So this is data that we have, and I said that this is a wide variety represented here. So you have population growth, and the second one over says real GDP, gross domestic product. What you should see there is simply shorthand for the human economy, including the global human economy. Those two drivers are what determines everything else that you see: human population and the human economy. Now, what's striking, whether it's foreign investment or damming of rivers or water use or fertilizer consumption or paper consumption or McDonald's restaurants or telephones or motor vehicles, is that they all represent what are sometimes called hockey stick or J-curve data. So you see what happens after 1950. 1950 is the end of World War II and the beginning of the post-war economy. And in the Roosevelt administration, there was a deliberate policy put in place to establish the institutions, took place at Bretton Woods, institutions for a global consumer economy. Now, that was the right decision at that time. You had tens of thousands of people coming home from the war who needed jobs. You had Europe and East Asia decimated by the war. So you needed to restore these countries and economies and provide jobs. So it was a deliberate effort to establish a global, thus International Development Fund, World Bank, the Bretton Woods institutions, and provide millions of jobs. And it was fantastically successful. The quarter century from 1950 to 1975 saw the greatest growth of a middle class anywhere up until that time. Now, since the 70s, wages have largely stagnated. But during that period of time, lots of folks who were poor became middle class in that quarter century because of the success of this. So there's been no time in all of human history when you've had such generation of collective wealth as you have had since 1950. And that's what you see here with the growth of that. Now, population also grew. The population in 1900 was 1.6 billion. The population in 2000, a century later, was the flip, was 6.1 billion. It took all of human history to get to 1900. And 1.6. And it then flipped in one century, and now we're adding a billion about every decade. So it's going up. All of these are still going up. Now, it isn't because family sizes are getting bigger. They're getting smaller. Birth rates are declining everywhere in the world, with the exception of some relatively small pockets. It's because we're living longer. I'm living a generation longer than my dad. And it's because children are surviving. It used to be that up to 40% of children died before the age of five. Nothing like that anymore. So it's not family size, it's because health and longevity are both on the increase. So that those and the GDP continues to grow. In fact, you can't find anybody who will talk about anything but economic growth. I don't care what candidate it is for president of the United States. That is our economic orthodoxy. And it's continuing to be the case. So this provided human well-being on a scale as measured by material well-being and health and long lives on a scale unprecedented in all of human history. Now, let's look at the second page of these graphs. The second page of these graphs is a set of the consequences that resulted from what you saw on the first page of graphs. What did this global human economy and this multiplication of unprecedented human numbers result in with respect to the planet? Now, I put on the board here some of the elements of Thomas Berry's thought. One of them is planetary health is primary, human well-being is derivative. The Industrial Revolution didn't even think about that. It focused on human well-being. And if that causes some problems, we'll clean it up. But Berry is right that if you have a degrading planet, the consequence is going to be a degrading set of problems for human beings as well. Because the human economy is always and everywhere rooted in and totally dependent upon nature's economy. No exceptions to that. So he's right. Planetary health is primary. Human well-being is derivative. You put it this way, planetary health is primary because human well-being is derivative. All right. Or another one from Berry. The first law of economics is preservation of Earth's economy. You can't have any human economy that doesn't depend upon Earth's economy, nature's economy. So the first law of economics is preservation of Earth's economy. It's not the continuation of economic growth. That's where we have lived our lives. It doesn't work. Or this is from Wendell Berry. You can't make this up. What is this? Thomas Berry, Wendell Berry, Judith Plant, Matthew Fox. I don't get it, but anyway, this is from Wendell Berry, different kind of Berry. Do unto those downstream from you as you would wish those upstream to do unto you. That's the version of the golden rule here now, when planetary health is primary, and the first law of economics is preservation of Earth's economy. All right, what were the consequences of this, for us, in many ways, wonderful post-World War II surge in the economy? The top three across are the greenhouse gases. So CO2, nitrous oxide, methane. And you see what has happened there. We've got exactly the same J-curves, exactly the same hockey sticks. And they're continuing there. Atmosphere ozone depletion, the climate surface temperatures. If you took the last 20 spring season, you would find out that spring is now 2 weeks earlier than it was 20 years ago. I live in Santa Fe. Our temperature is ratcheting up slowly, and our precipitation is falling slowly. Well, that's this one is surface temperature, floods, ocean ecosystems. We're paying attention primarily to the coral reefs, which are bleaching and in many cases dying. Even the grandest of them all, the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, is seriously in decline. Now, scuba divers will regret that because they're beautiful, but the ocean regrets that because those are the nurseries of about 40% of ocean life. Even though coral reefs only occupy 2% of the ocean floor. Well, that's how much is dependent there. And so that's ocean ecosystems. Those are rainforests. They're underwater rainforests. The coastal zone structures, what happens when you remove wetlands off of New Orleans, other effects of the surges now and storms, the coastal zone biochemistry is changing, loss of tropical rainforest and woodland, loss of domesticated land, and I mean it's been paved over, and then global diversity. This is probably the scariest of them all, is the loss of biodiversity. There have been only 5 mass extinctions in the history of the planet, where you've had a major dying. Species are always dying. Species are coming into being. That's the way nature works. But there are, on occasion, and they're rare, also mass extinctions. There's only one mass extinction that has happened in the time that Homo sapiens, human beings, have been around, which is the last 200,000 years. And it's going on now. And the rate of extinction is increasing, not decreasing. So we're in the 6th mass extinction. The scientists, well, it's trying to authenticate me again. scientists are worried that we may lose half of the present species, although we don't actually know how many species there are. We really don't have a very good idea of how many species there are. But they're pretty confident that we're in this 6th mass extinction. So what are the alternatives to continuing those graphs? Namely, that which has produced human well-being and longevity, on the one hand, how do you continue that in such a way that you don't degrade the rest of nature that we know? Not the whole universe, but this particular planet, relatively small one from part of the solar system of a kind of middling star in a galaxy of a billion stars, that galaxy being one of probably 100 billion galaxy with similar numbers of planets and solar systems. Well, Thomas Berry, in the great work, Our Way into the Future, has sought to contribute what he calls a viable functional cosmology. He argues that the story of the universe and the human in the universe, and the human in the cosmos, is our proper grounding story. We are cosmic creatures. We come from stardust. There is no life on this planet that does not originate in the death of exploding stars. I mean, it's the grace of star death that vetted your life. And Barry says we should take this story that we're a part of seriously. We belong to an immense story, and we're part of an immense journey that, in his judgment, should shape our outlook and our habits. So that's kind of the backstory of where this documentary that we'll see before long comes from. And today's session will be to view that documentary. And then the session on Wednesday and the session on Friday, we're going to take some interviews conducted by Mary Evelyn Tucker with a variety of persons, economists, biologists, city planters, people in the arts, all telling us how the story of the universe shapes their story and their work. It's part of this effort to say, what's the connection between this immense journey we're all on and the habits and ways of our day-to-day life? So we'll listen to Carl Anthony, who's an urban designer and important in the environmental justice movement, talk about race and the journey of the universe. that's just one example. That'll be Wednesday and Friday. But before we do that, we have to talk about cosmology. I mean, human beings are maybe above all storytellers, and they live out the stories they tell about themselves. That's why I found the in Bible study so engaging this morning. The people of Israel always trying to find the right story or tell the right story or be the right people in light of the story that they're told about who they are. Well, that's a general human condition. We're storytellers. And but when people do live out the big story of their lives, they're rarely conscious about it. Things come up where they have to think, now, what is reality for me? But if I'm sitting next to my seatmate in my row on the airplane, and I ask her, or request, tell me your cosmology. How is your reality working for you today? I might get a good conversation. I might also get something like, let me get back to you on that. Or I'll probably end up doing the crossword puzzle at that time. But I might also get the question, what do you mean by cosmology? You're telling me that we all have cosmologies. It is our picture of reality, or call it your worldview. It's your big story. But we don't think about it, unless you have to take a philosophy class. The folks who use this word all the time, though, are some scientists, especially physicists. And one of the narrators of this, Brian Swim, is an astrophysicist. Astronomers talk about cosmology all the time, and a delightful book some of you will know about is Neil deGrasse Tyson's book, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. Yeah, it's a good one. He tells you there how the universe works. The immutable natural laws governing everything on Earth and in the heavens. And in the DVD we'll watch, the scientific cosmology is narrated by astrophysicist Brian Swim. And what he narrates is what is now called the common creation story that science collectively gives us. It's the history of the universe from the Big Bang to the present. And includes, it's the evolution of the universe that includes the evolution of life. on this planet. But it's not just scientific cosmologies that we have. In fact, the ones that are most important to most of us are the religious and cultural cosmologies. They're the big stories too, and they're the story not about how the universe works, but about the meaning of it. So, for example, when we read Genesis, we don't read it for in search of sound science. We read it for who we are in the scheme of things. And in the face of God as human beings in God's big creation. We read other big and little stories, the flood, the parables of Jesus, the exile, the vision of a new heaven and a new earth, with the same quest for meaning in mind. That's religious cosmology. It tries to answer the question, how do we fit in here? And what does it mean that we're here and now, here and now? Now, these religious cosmologies are almost always part of cultural cosmologies and often shape them. Or conversely, the cultural cosmologies shape religious interpretations. Let me give you an example off of these slides. The Industrial Revolution fostered a certain relationship of human beings with the rest of nature, a dualistic relationship. So we thought of ourselves as over against nature, humanity, nature, human beings, creation. That's the kind of dualism that was fostered. And I'll read you the assumptions that we made in this cosmology. It's the one I grew up on, and many of you did, because it's the one that's been lived out as the modern way of life. These assumptions comprise the cosmology of a whole way of life. I'm going to cite Earth Honoring Faith. It's one of the books in the bookstore for sale. Here are the assumptions of this cosmology. See if you recognize this as your own. Nature is a virtually limitless storehouse of resources for human use. Humanity has the commission to use and control nature. Nature is malleable and can be reconfigured for human ends. Humanity has the right, perhaps even the calling, to use culture nature's resources for an improvement in the material standard of living. The most effective means to raise material standards of living is ongoing economic growth. The quality of life is furthered by an economic system directed to ever-expanding material abundance. The future is open, systematic material progress for the whole human race is possible, and through the careful use of human powers, humanity can make history turn out right. Human failures can be overcome through effective problem solving. Problem solving will be effective if reason and goodwill are present and science and technology are developed and applied in a free environment. Science and technology are neutral means for serving chosen ends. Modern science and technology, coupled with democracy, have helped achieve a superior civilization, first in the West, then for the rest. What can be scientifically known and technologically done should be known and done. The things we create are under our control. That's my favorite. The things we create are under our control. The good life is one of productive labor and material well-being. The successful person is one who achieves and is on his or her own. Both social progress and individual interests are best served by achievement-oriented behavior in a competitive and entrepreneurial environment. A work ethic is essential to human satisfaction and eco-social progress. The diligent, hard-working, risk-taking, and educated will attain their goals. There is freedom in material abundance. When people have more, their freedom of choice is expanded, and they can and they will be more.
What page is that on?
Page 75. I'll read the follow-up. All of this is first cousin to Frederick Morton's Crosstown Sabbath. Morton, narrating the experience of riding the 42nd Street Crosstown bus in New York City, describes the fatigue on the faces of the passengers as classically Judeo-Christian. We are imitating the God of our civilization, Morton says, the workaholic supernal who assembled the world in factory terms. Before the Hebrews, no other people had a Sabbath, he writes. No other people needed one. Anyway, I'll jump back just for a second. We're about ready to watch the documentary. I'll jump back just for a second to the graphs without picking them up there, because they are descriptive of human beings in an aggregate sense. And it's important for us to talk about who we are as a species. Species talk is absolutely necessary because we make judgments all the time about what human nature is and allows or doesn't allow and ought to try to be. But that doesn't sort out who, for whom this wealth was generated and where it resides. So those graphs don't tell you that one of the great issues for us is inequality and the unsustainability that it promotes in society. That shows you the unsustainability of maintaining this kind of way of life in light of what it does to nature. So there's a lot more to talk about, and that's why there are other sessions. So to summarize this, portion, this documentary assumes a scientific cosmology, science's common creation story, and it is in quest of a different religious and cultural cosmology than the one that has dominated the modern world, namely industrialized nature in the hands of a dominant, separate, and superior species. We think of ourselves as a superior species, set apart from the rest of them. We don't think of ourselves as one among 10 million or 15 million species with the question, how do we relate to the rest? So this is the functional ecology and cosmology that wants to find a new story to live by. A story that's a synthesis of scientific and religious cosmology. So, cosmology, our picture of reality and its meaning, that's not everything. And I have to talk about one more thing and then... I could pick this up later. Let's watch the video. If you want to take a potty break, now would be a good time, and we'll be ready to watch this. Or would you rather just sit through this?
Yeah.
All right, you ready to go?
Yeah.
Okay. Roll it. All right, we have a little time left. That's the journey of the universe as science presents it now as a common creation story. And I want to ask the question of what tugs at you, having seen this. What is your initial response? Are there particular emotions that register? Are there insights that arise? What is it that tugs with you. And I may ask on Wednesday what lingers with you, because oftentimes it's after we've seen this a while and awakened from the afternoon nap or the morning after, that something is important that we didn't register at the time. I love Joanna Macy's comment. I just try to act my age. My atoms are 14 billion years old. Well, Brian Swim would have us all trying to act our age after realizing this. Or I love the comment of the Crow Nation of Montana. We love the stars, and the stars love us back. Okay, what is it? What is it that one more thing, just as the comment of Brian Swim toward the end, a couple of them. One of them, in the past few generations, we have profoundly altered the dynamics of the Earth, including its evolution. That's those two sets of graphs. But the way in which it's talked about nowadays in some scientific circles, especially among geologists, is that for the first time in human history, we have entered upon a new geological epoch. All of human history has been lived in the late Holocene. Holocene is Greek for the holy recent period, holy, W-H-O-L-L-Y. And we have so altered the dynamics of the Earth that we're now entering a new geological epoch called the Anthropocene. Greek from Anthropos, in your New Testament, human, the age of the human, or the age of human dominance is what it means. God only knows why all geologists only speak Greek, but they do. And so we're moving from the late Holocene to the early Anthropocene. We've only lived in the late Holocene up to this point. And having now profoundly altered the dynamics of Earth, Brian Swim asks, is there any deep wisdom to guide us? And he says, wonder will guide us. So that's his response to the journey of the universe. Awe and wonder. And that's where we go for guidance. And we're what is uniquely human about, or what is unique about human beings is this self-consciousness as symbolic consciousness and the kind of creativity. Now, you have to immediately say that every species is unique. So he's trying to isolate human beings. But I don't want to lose the question. What tugs at you? Please.
I couldn't sit here and watch this without thinking, where is God in the midst of this?
Yes.
You know, trying to get my head around, you know, is it God given that we're discovering all of this? Is it, you know, and what are we being called upon to learn and to do as a person of faith, as people of faith? And that's going to keep me awake.
Yeah, yes. I'm so glad you brought this up, and right at the outset. And the little bit that we should know about this is that this is created as a story of science in order to be in dialogue with our religious and faith traditions. They avoid getting into any particular tradition in here. I mean, he uses a couple of churches. It actually ends here with the psalm to renew the face of the earth. But they don't go there. And when you talk with Mary Evelyn Tucker, whom you'll host the interviews that we'll watch the next two sessions, and with Brian Swim about this. What they will say is, from their own point of view, we live in a sacred cosmos. We live in a sacred creation. But even that isn't discussed. What I want to do on Friday is ask the question, what difference does sacred make for us now in this enormous challenge? And but you're so good to bring up the question of where is God here, or what is God communicating by way of this? Sometimes Swim gets kind of close when he talks with his balloon there, you know, a millionth of 1% difference, it collapses or explodes. Well, you know, we could talk about God at that point, I suppose. But maybe there's much more. Maybe the whole journey is itself. For Thomas Berry, who's behind all of this, for Thomas Berry, the universe is revelatory. And he says, scriptures, yes, scriptures, written scriptures are important. Of course, that's what we do to try to interrogate this journey in order to render it meaningful or to tease out its meaning. But Berry will say, the universe is the only text without a greater context, unless you want to talk about God as a greater context for this text. Yeah. And someone want to follow up on that first?
In our Judeo-Christian traditions, and also yeah. the traditions of other faiths around the world as well, there's a stewardship component to our faith.
Yeah.
And what struck me is that while we have been the agent of the most change in the last, since the Industrial Revolution,
yeah.
It's our responsibility to be the steward. Good stewards.
Yeah.
And it strikes me that our country is one of only three that didn't ratify the Paris Peace Climate Accords.
Yeah. First one to pull out.
Two of those other countries, Syria was in middle civil war. They didn't, that's right, they didn't. Yeah. Central American country didn't ratify it because they didn't think it would harm.
Right.
So if you go back to the stewardship component,
yeah.
we have caused the greatest harm.
Yeah.
But we have the wherewithal to affect the change that we're on the precipice right now.
Mm-hmm.
On a very steep precipice.
Yeah.
Do we plunge off?
Yeah.
Does it make us extinct too, along with half the other mammals and other creatures of the earth? Because we might be extinct ourselves if we go off this precipice. But being on the edge, what can pull us back from it?
Yeah.
And stewardship is part of it, and I think that's a key component of our faith, because God would want us to steward, be good stewards of the earth that He created for us.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, thank you. In Islam, you have a lovely image for us along those lines. Muslims talk about human beings as companions of the garden. You know. So, there's a lot of discussion in Christian environmental ethics about stewardship. Much of it is critical of the, not the notion in general, but the way in which we've understood stewardship, which is one which puts us over against that which we're stewards of. And it disconnects us from that which we are to steward. It abstracts the human rather than seeing us as companions or as connected to, and that life of the water and that life of the air is who we are. And even in some of our very best traditions, like social justice traditions, we don't allow other than human creatures to make moral claims upon us. Water doesn't make a moral claim upon us in our view, nor does the air. So there's a lot of discussion about whether social justice is more urgent than ever, because climate impacts are the worst upon those who are most vulnerable and who have contributed least to climate system change. But unless social justice is creation justice and planetary health is a part of one's justice making, then the very resources for doing social justice are themselves threatened. You can't have an improving human community on a degrading planet for the long haul. So I'm not going to get deep into this, but I just say that stewardship, one has to ask, how is that understood? How is that imagined? What is the relationship between the steward and what is being stewarded? How do the claims become mutual claims? How is there reciprocity between subject and subject rather than subject and object? The heart of the Industrial Revolution ethic is an utterly utilitarian ethic in which everything is there for the responsible use of human beings. And sometimes stewardship hasn't understood the reciprocity involved, but it certainly is a vital symbol.
Living in South Dakota, I have been able to have a particular connection with the Rosebud Indian Reservation. And as you're saying, stewardship, I think it's one of the cultural pieces that has been a disconnect for our Native brothers and sisters and those of us that live in the white man's world. Yeah. They have struggled to maintain their understanding of stewardship and their connection to creation and the land in the midst of our industrializing and using of the earth's resources.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful for this because it's making me think in different ways.
Yeah.
With that knowledge.
Pope Francis, in the encyclical Laudato Si, which is, I think, one of the most extraordinary documents of the whole modern period, talking about climate system change, talks about it's those who suffer first and most are those who contributed the least to it. He goes on to say in there that, and they're usually minority, whether it's minority communities. He goes on to see there is among the minority communities, there is a special place for indigenous peoples because as dialogue partners in this quest. And the purpose of the papal encyclical is to encourage a dialogue, the kind that we're trying to facilitate here and the kind that Journey of the Universe is trying to facilitate. And he said the reason for the prioritizing of the wisdom of indigenous peoples is because they've had a cosmology in which they understand the human's connection to the land. We're water people. We're soil people. We're animal people. And those are connections that need to be nurtured rather than severed. Yeah,
and Industrial Revolution has caused us to separate.
Yeah, actually, if you look at the history of ethics, what the Industrial Revolution did with respect to the human vis-a-vis the rest of nature was to continue in a different way the master-slave ethic, in which we are masters and the rest of nature is slave. And the decisions about the slave's welfare will be made in terms of the decisions about the master's welfare, you know. So it's a pretty deep kind of critique, and you won't have to talk long with anyone from an indigenous nation to have them nodding their head. Yeah, you got it. Finally, you got it. Colonization was a master-slave enterprise. Conquest was a master-slave enterprise. Slavery was there for the sake of King Cotton, tobacco, sugar, rice as monocrops in the new economy. Yeah. Okay, back to what tugs at you here. Yes.
My first thought when you asked that question was, who has the privilege of seeing this video besides us?
Yeah.
I'd love to shoot that at a college class and have them dissected for a semester.
Yeah.
I think a high school class would be mature enough to at least see it and get some basic stuff. I think, I mean, many of us are a little mature. And we're all...
Nice term. Thank you.
Fearful of the outcome. And so the young need to be initiated into the same concerns that we have in this room.
Yeah. This has been actually amazingly successful in different audiences. But they do regard a certain level, I would say high school. Level to kind of take it in, but there are about 20 or 24 conversations in an educational series which takes this apart, and we'll be looking at just a few of them. Those are wonderful resources for working with us. We did it in our church with a few of them, and it was a strong response that is still playing out there. When they've done Journey of the Universe, they've done it around the world now. When they've done Journey of the Universe in China, they've had packed houses in the biggest arenas available. I mean, it's stunning how it's kind of caught on in different settings. Yep, here.
I was going to say that. Where is God in this narrative?
Yeah.
As often as not in my faith journey, my concept of God has had to expand.
Mm.
A common perception is that God is static. A specific spot being whatever, however you want to say, but God is static. That's God.
Yeah.
And maybe that's only because a little meager head bone can only allow for that. But what if God is much larger than how I've ever imagined?
Yeah.
What if God is more than I can even imagine?
Yeah.
What if God is expanding?
Yeah. A couple of quick responses to that. My rabbi, I have a rabbi in Sacramento, Nahum Ward Levin. I'm not in it now, but for a while was in the discussion group that met every week for studying Torah. And it was Christians and Jews, about half and half. But Nahum's argument as a rabbi, or his scholarship as a rabbi, is that God is evolving. But we can never tell exactly how, because we're the ones that are realizing
exactly.
that is our God, or yeah, or is it my understanding of God that's evolving? But he thinks that God learns, and if you're a good Jew, God makes some doozers of mistakes, and you can argue with God about that, and you do argue with God. That's sort of one response. The argument about God is bigger than what I've imagined is an ancient Christian one. Augustine says, if you understand God, you haven't understood God. I mean, and the Greek tradition, Greek Orthodox tradition, has two kinds of theology. One pursuing who God is and what we are like, and seeks language to do that and all sorts of forms. The other one is apophatic. It's silence. We cannot know that mystery. And that knowledge that we cannot know the depths, the extent of that mystery is part of the theology.
This got me thinking.
What?
I was speaking from the balcony.
So ah, the, yeah.
The voice from on high.
Yeah.
It got me thinking about time. I think David Suzuki has written that it's the concept of the future is one thing that distinguishes.
Yes.
I think it's also a concept of the past, and we have this story, beginning, middle, maybe end.
Yeah.
And this unfolding of time, and is so several things. What makes one? I mean, to what? Where's God in time, or where's time in God? When we're in eternity, where those things come together. But then, as humans, time seems to be a big problem for us. We can make a lot of short-term decisions. Yeah, this is going to be good for us tomorrow.
Yeah.
The investors are concerned about quarterly profits.
Yeah.
But it's the long-term thing that's the sustainability problem that we have a really hard time thinking long-term. I don't know where this goes. This is what this made me think.
The dilemma of the Anthropocene, this period of human domination, is the dilemma that our powers have increased to the point that we're making these fundamental changes in the planet's core operating systems, not internal core, but its core surface operating systems, the oceans, the atmosphere, what's happening on the land masses, the way we're using them. All of that is changing under the impact of human power. The consequences of those are in space and in time long term. We actually don't have a foggiest notion of what we're doing in as far as the long-term consequences and outcome are concerned. So the question for one's spirituality is, what kind of relationship then should our powers have to the rest of nature? What should characterize our actions when we can't know the eventual consequences of them? So yeah, well, the precautionary principle is a pretty good one at that point. I think the argument for nonviolent love becomes a practical argument. What nurtures nonviolent love? Because it's likelier that the relationships that are characterized that way are going to do less harm. I mean, that's nothing is a guarantee, but one has to somehow respond. And there's a wonderful letter by Thomas Merton to a young activist. This is a long time ago. This is Jim Forrest was an activist opposing the Vietnam War. And he was just getting so discouraged because his actions and the actions of other protesters weren't getting any kind of response. And so he writes to Thomas Merton, and Thomas Merton, who's also an active Roman Catholic writer, monk, against the Vietnam War and against and in favor of the civil rights movement at the same time, writes back a letter to a young activist. And in that letter to a young activist, he makes the argument for a relationship to everything in terms of nonviolent love. And then you're just going to have to let God sort it out in the end, because you don't really know what you're doing. Things are so deeply interconnected that what I do ramifies in a different way because of the systems of which I'm a part around the world.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you to everybody. We're continuing on this on Wednesday with some interviews with people. All right.